In his latest book, A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, David Blight tells the stories and reprints the narratives of Wallace Turnage, who escaped from a plantation in Alabama, and John Washington, an urban slave from Virginia. Mr. Blight is director of Yale's Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. His book is published by Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And although your name is on the front cover, the fly leaf or whatever this is called, you share authorship with the two former slaves.
Well, indeed, I should. It is their stories that I'm telling, and I'm also publishing their stories in their reprinted autobiographies.
Did you discover the slave narratives of Wallace Turnage and John Washington at the same time?
Yes, although I didn't necessarily discover them on my own. These two rare, extraordinary manuscripts were brought to me in the same roughly six-month period about 4 years ago. One of them by a literary agent working on behalf of its owner in Boston, John Washington, and the other from the Greenwich, Connecticut Historical Society. Neither owner knew about the other, but both of them lopped them in my lap at roughly the same time.
And you say it's a remarkable story how each of them wound up at their location. John Washington's at the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston, and Wallace Turnage in the Greenwich Historical Society in Connecticut.
It is. They're both, in a sense, box in the attic stories that came down through families. John Washington's narrative ended up in Boston because his granddaughter ended up in possession of it in the 1970s and left it with a close friend when she became elderly. That close friend worked on the document for years and collected other documents, and then became elderly herself and left it to her son, who is a man named Julian Houston, in Boston today. The other, Wallace Turnage's narrative ended up in Greenwich because his daughter lived to be 99 years old and lived in Greenwich, passing for white, dying not until 1984. She lived there as a hotel worker. And when she died, she left a box of material to a close friend who sat on it for some 18 years, and after watching a television documentary about slave narratives, gave it to the Greenwich Historical Society. And that's how both of them have come to me.
Do many slave narratives survive?
No, not many at all. From the end of the Civil War to the 1920s, when the last of slaves who wrote about themselves died off, we only have about 55 such autobiographies in one form or another, post-emancipation narratives. So these are rare, but these are also unusual because neither of these was ever published, never edited, never touched by any process of publication.
There have been oral histories.
There have been oral histories, thousands of them, done by the WPA in the 1930s.
And they were often, some of what was in them was questioned because there was a concern about the people who were taking down the information, but that wouldn't happen here.
No, it wouldn't happen here. The concern about the WPA oral histories, of course, was that most of the subjects were in their 80s and sometimes 90s, and indeed most of the interviewers were white and so forth. Some of them were quite brief, and most of them were recollecting childhood memories of slavery. In these two cases, they are constructed autobiographies written in either the 1870s or 1880s.
And did you have to have them authenticated?
Well, I authenticated them myself, and that was a fairly easy process. That was, in fact, the easiest part of the research on this project. Once I could see the originals in their own handwriting, I could tell I was working with authentic documents. But I was also able to authenticate them by a variety of tests of their knowledge of geography, their knowledge of events, their knowledge of time, people, places. And through that process, I was able to tell I was working with two very real slave narratives.
Did they leave any official documents behind? Were the birth and death certificates, marriage certificates?
Oh, yes. I was able to reconstruct their post-emancipation lives from a whole variety of documents like the ones you mentioned, but also from Friedman's bank records, from census manuscripts, from city directories, from some church records, and so on. And through that process, the painstaking filtering of these relatively obscure documents about ordinary and unknown people, I was at least able to find them, where they lived, how they worked, what their families were like, the churches they belonged to, where they moved to, their communities, and indeed where they're buried. So what I was able to do here is not simply publish these slave narratives, but to round out the lives of two working-class African-American former slaves who made lives, struggling lives, in northern cities in the late 19th century.
My guest is David W. Blight, the director of Yale University's Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery Resistance and Abolition, professor of American history. Among his books is Race and Reunion, which won the Frederick Douglass Prize, the Lincoln Prize, and the Bancroft Prize. His latest book, A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation, published by Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about these men. When and where was John Washington born?
Washington was born in Fredericksburg, Virginia in 1838.
Significant that he comes from the state that George Washington came from?
It is significant, and at one point we thought we might have him distantly related to a cousin of George Washington's, but that did not turn out. I have never been able to determine exactly who Washington's father was, because there are so many Washingtons in the state of Virginia, and he never tells us. His mother was a slave woman named Sarah, later Sarah Tucker. But the important thing in John Washington's youth is that he grows up in a city. He's an urban slave. He was obviously very bright, skilled, and highly valued. He was frequently hired out by his owners, about four times, indeed, before his escape in 1862. And he lived a life of some relative freedom of movement. He attained a degree of informal education, although he tells us his mother first taught him how to read and write. He also had some tutoring from a white minister, from one of his uncles, and so forth. And he is positioned, therefore, to have an element of control over his life before he escaped in 1862.
And what led to his escape?
What led to his escape is the arrival of the Union Army. The Union forces arrived on the Rappahannock River in April of 1862, and John had been biding his time and planning for this for a very long time. And at that point, he was hired out to a hotel named the Shakespeare. And he tells the quite dramatic story of how the white guests and indeed owners of the hotel were all evacuating the city on the 18th of April, 1862. And yet the dozen or so black workers, most of them slaves, went up on the roof of the hotel so they could see the Yankee troops across the river and see what he called their glistening bayonets. He then brings them down into the kitchen, and John was kind of the assistant manager of the hotel. The owner had given him a wad of bills to pay off the help. He pays off the help, he poured a round of drinks, and he holds a toast. And the toast was to the Yankees. And then he instructs his fellow workers to simply get out of there, but as he says, don't get too far from the Yankees. And John escaped by simply walking up the river and crossing the Rappahannock to a group of Union troops from the 21st New York Regiment, who formally, in effect, freed him on that day.
Do you consider it fortuitous that Wallace Turnage's life was so different?
Well, fortuitous perhaps, but...
Because it gives you a wider sense of what slavery was all about.
Exactly. The reason these two work so well together is that they're complementary in the sense of their pursuit of their own freedom in the midst of the chaos of war, but they escape in very different circumstances from quite different experiences. Turnage is born on a small tobacco farm near Snow Hill, North Carolina, in 1846, so he was some 8 years younger. His father he knew. His father's name was Sylvester Brown Turnage. He was the stepson of his mistress, of his owner. His mother was a woman named Courtney, a slave woman, who also taught him his first alphabet, which makes both of these young men fortunate and quite extraordinary.
They're both a mixed race.
They are both a mixed race.
Was that a factor?
Well, it was surely a factor for John Washington because his light skin in the city of Fredericksburg probably was an asset to him, particularly in the minds and eyes of other whites. It probably led to certain kinds of privileges he might not otherwise have had. In Wallace Turnage's case, there's no evidence that his light skin served to any advantage because his experience, of course, is ultimately of the severe brutality of a cotton plantation in Alabama.
And he was sold twice, wasn't
he? He was first sold at age 14 in 1860 to a Richmond, Virginia slave trader in whose two-story auction house for about 6 months Wallace worked, organizing slave auctions. And then in mid-1860, he was sold one day to an Alabama planter named Chalmers. And he found himself 3 days later on a large cotton operation near Pickensville, Alabama. And his narrative is then largely the story of his five attempts to escape in the midst of the Civil War, finally succeeding in Mobile Bay in 1864.
What ways did he try to escape?
Well, his first four attempts to escape were over in the Mississippi. He kept trying to go north along the Ohio and Mobile Railway line. He was trying to get to the northern tier of Mississippi, particularly by 1862, because the Union armies controlled that region. And he was also trying to get to Corinth, Mississippi, which by 1862 had one of the largest contraband camps anywhere in the South. These were camps of freed people living largely in tents. And there were some 6,000 freedmen living there by the end of 1862. But each time, and the last time he was at large over 4 months, each time he is captured, his owner comes to get him because he's so valuable, and he is returned to the cotton plantation in Alabama. His owner finally, in early 1863, was fed up with this young runaway who was now 17 years old, and he took him to Mobile and sold him at the slave pen, or the slave auction house of Mobile, once again, his third time, this time for $2,000. And he was sold to a Mobile merchant named Minge, and he served then most of the next year as a kind of jack-of-all-trades domestic servant for a family in Mobile.
And then in 1864, he walked for 3 weeks down the western shore of Mobile Bay through snake-infested swamps, mm-hmm. and finally found an old rowboat to use and was rescued by a Union gunboat. And you can't help but be stunned by the reaction of the Union soldiers.
Yeah, indeed.
This was not the happiest ending.
No, it wasn't. And it's the most dramatic moment in Turnage's narrative. You can actually feel him on the page trying to capture it. He finds an old rowboat drawn in by the tide one morning after this three-week trek through the Fowl River estuary. He was half-starved and barely alive, but he rows that boat out into the bay, which is the ocean, and he tells us he began to hear oars, and the oars were from a Union gunboat. They holler to him, "Jump in." He jumps into their boat, and then there's this moment where he describes sitting down in the boat, and he says the Yankee sailors were stunned with silence when they looked at me. And indeed, they may have been. They took him to a sand island fort and clothed him and fed him. The next day, he was rowed to Dauphin Island, to a big fort, the beautiful ruins of which are still there, Fort Gaines. And he was brought before General Gordon Granger, the commander of all Union forces in the Mobile region, and given two choices. He could either join a black regiment, or he could become a servant to a white officer, and Wallace chose the latter.
Because he understood that life better?
Well,
to some degree,
it's hard to know.
It's a modified version of slavery, isn't it?
Well, not really, because if he got himself a good person, and it appears that he did, he at least had safekeeping. And for this kid, at this point, he'd been through so much hell and suffering that the idea of becoming a cook to a Union officer probably looked a little better than the risk he would take by shouldering a musket.
My guest is David W. Blight. His latest book, A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation, published by Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after this. And we're back with David W. Blight, the director of Yale University's Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition, a professor of American history at Yale. And his latest book is called The Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation, the two men being Wallace Turnage, who lived until 1916, and John Washington, who lived until 1918. The book is published by Harcourt. Do either of their narratives include much information about what happened to them after the Civil War?
No, that's the most frustrating part. Both of them end their narratives largely right after they had escaped. Washington in the early fall of 1862 and Turnage after he escapes in 1864. You want to grab them by the collar at that point and shake them and say, no, don't stop.
Because everything is getting interesting.
Exactly. Where did you go? What happened to your lives? This was my challenge. I was able to discover that Turnage was with this Maryland regiment until the end of the war and after. He was probably with them when they were mustered out in Baltimore in August of 1865. He lived 3 years in Baltimore, during which time he returned to North Carolina. He had to have at least once to retrieve his mother, his siblings, because they all end up in the census in New York City by 1870. And indeed, that's where Wallace moved, and he would live the rest of his life in either Manhattan or across the river in Jersey City until 1916. He worked in every kind of common laborer job. I found at least 8 or 9 such designations, from night watchman to bartender to even one time he was called a general jobber. He joined the Abyssinian Baptist Church, where he was married 3 times. He had 2 wives die on him. He had 7 children.
Any of them, were you able to talk to any of them or to their children?
No, indeed. Only 3 of his children survived. 4 of them died in infancy. But one of those daughters, of course, was Lydia Turnage Connolly, who saved her grandfather's narrative in a beautiful black box, along with 4 beautiful photographs of her father, which were taken in studios in his Sunday finest suit, and indeed a photograph of her when she was only about 18.
So that was how you were able to track him to New York City? Otherwise, he could have gone anywhere.
He could have gone anywhere, but it is remarkable what one can discover through census manuscripts, city directories, newspapers, obituaries, bank records, and so forth, even about the most ordinary of people, obscure people. Turnage, for example, also joined a fraternal order. It was called the Hamilton Lodge. And it indeed he is buried to this day, along with his wives and some of his children, in the collective burial plot of that lodge in Cypress Hill Cemetery in Brooklyn.
And Washington had 5 sons who survived him.
He did. He ended up in Washington, D.C. as part of the first wave of freedmen who escaped into Washington. Ultimately, about 40,000 freed people ended up in the District of Columbia. He lived the rest of his life, or almost the rest of his life, until 1913 when he moved in Washington, D.C. He married Annie Gordon, his childhood sweetheart from Fredericksburg, who was a free black woman. They had 5 sons, his sons clearly came to possess a certain value about education, particularly his youngest son, Benjamin. Graduated from Howard University, attended summer school at Harvard, and ended up a science teacher at the Armstrong Academy in Washington, D.C. until late in old age. He didn't die until 1957, and indeed there's a wonderful rounding out of his story as well. I was able to find a lot about his youngest son through newspapers because he became the commissioner of the Black Collegiate Football Conference on the East Coast, and there was a lot of coverage of that. And the last reference I found to Benjamin Washington, John Washington's son, was at a meeting where they were in the wake of the Brown v. Board decision trying to decide whether the black colleges should integrate or play white colleges in 1956.
Isn't there an 89-year-old granddaughter, Ruth Washington?
There is indeed. Some 6 weeks ago now, after a lot of digging, my research assistant, Christine McKay, found through an obituary in a New Jersey newspaper a surviving granddaughter of John Washington. Her name is Ruth Washington. She is 89 years old. She lives in a retirement trailer park village in Tampa, Florida. And I just, 1 week ago, in fact, brought her and her niece, the great-great-granddaughter, to Fredericksburg, Virginia for a special event in the old Baptist church where they came back to their ancestral home. The remarkable thing about the discovery of this descendant is that Ruth Washington, John's granddaughter, knew virtually nothing about her grandfather. She is a case of an African-American family that, in effect, closed her off and closed off other members of her family to their slave past. She was never told anything about her grandfather, and her own father, John Jr., died when she was only 18. But she has embraced this book and embraced the story, and I must tell you, Leonard, she gave an extraordinary speech to an audience last week in a Baptist church in Fredericksburg, in effect thanking everybody, but also expressing what it means to discover such a piece of your past late in old age and indeed to embrace it.
We often hear from survivors, the children of survivors of the Holocaust, that they were unwilling to talk about their experiences. I'm assuming the same thing happened to people who had lived through slavery.
It is comparable.
Although in this case, these men married women who had also been slaves, had they?
Indeed. It is comparable in the sense that we know, and I know from my earlier research for the book Race and Reunion, that for thousands of African Americans in the late 19th and early 20th century, the last thing they sometimes wanted to do within their families or their churches or particularly in public was to dwell upon the past. They were all trying to struggle, to survive, to make new lives, to prosper. And there is simply no question that going back to slavery and indeed having to shoulder up to what the larger society considered the shame of slavery was not the easiest thing to do. However, that meant that a lot of young African Americans in the early 20th and mid-20th century often grew up not knowing anything about their grandparents, where their grandparents came from. And in this case, all of these Washington daughters, great-granddaughters, and great-great-granddaughters all went to Hampton University in Virginia and yet never knew they had roots in Virginia.
My guest is David W. Blight, whose latest book is A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation, published by Harcourt. So why did they write these narratives? And, well, and I mean, I've already asked you why you think they ended them with their escape from slavery, but why write them at all?
Well, you know, they never told us. In part, all I can do is speculate, but surely they possess what all autobiographers do. It's the will to be known is the will to write. We also know that autobiography often comes best from those who've experienced some kind of great dislocation, some kind of transformation from there to here, or as Richard Rodriguez once called it, a two-life lifetime. I was once there, now I'm here. There's also perhaps a kind of survivor spirit in writing these. Washington wrote his in 1873. Turnage does not date his, although he probably wrote it a bit later. But we might also consider the fact that they may have simply written them for their children. John Washington writes his the year his fifth and final son was born. And it may have been simply that he was motivated by wanting those sons to know who he was, where he came from, where they came from.
Now, Turnage came to New York, which had a lot of economic connections to the South.
It did.
Did that present problems to former slaves?
Well, the biggest problem former slaves faced in New York City was finding employment, meaningful employment.
What was, I'm assuming racism was rampant.
It was rampant.
Even though the Civil War had been won and Reconstruction was in effect at least for a time.
It was rampant, and New York City, as you may know, was run by the Democratic Party in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, by and large, a white supremacist political party. New York was riven with racism. He lived first in what was then known as Little Africa, a community of some 2,000 blacks, mostly former slaves, in what we today know as Greenwich Village. He lived at 113 Thompson Street and at number 13 Minetta Lane, later made famous by Jacob Riis and How the Other Half Lives, and even by Stephen Crane in some of his sketches, a notorious street of crime.
Now a very high-rent district.
Oh, a high-rent district, a beautiful street. I have a photograph, indeed, in the book of the actual address at which Turnage had lived. His first two children, indeed, were born on that street amidst all those saloons, and I think it probably had something to do with why he moved over to Jersey City, because those first two born children died in infancy of tuberculosis.
There was a lot of New York banking was connected to it, and their mortgages had been taken out, $4 billion in mortgages based on slave ownership.
Indeed.
What kind of impact did that have on New York business?
Well, slavery had an enormous impact on New York business long before the Civil War.
Well, we had slavery here.
We had slavery here in New York until the 1820s, and even trickles of it in the wake of the 1827 emancipation. But New York merchants, New York banking firms were deeply invested in slavery and also deeply invested in Southern land before the American Civil War. And indeed, at the outbreak of the Civil War, as the recent exhibition at the New York Historical Society showed us, the majority of New Yorkers by far did not vote for Lincoln, did not vote Republican in 1860 or in 1864. This was a city with deep ties to the South, to the cotton trade in particular, and therefore to the preservation of slavery.
And Connecticut had slavery even longer.
Connecticut's slave system actually ended by a gradual plan even before New York's, and it had much fewer slaves. Although you're right, slaves still existed, trickles of them, in Connecticut into the 1820s, even the 1830s.
Remember, we did a show on with a slave narrative from Connecticut.
On Venture Smith, probably, yeah.
How well were these autobiographies written?
Well, they're extraordinary pieces of writing in the sense that both men had bad grammar, bad spelling. They apologize right on the page for it. In fact, the opening sentence of Wallace Turnage's narrative is, quote, Wallace Turnage's apology for his book. Neither had a deep sense, a rich sense of syntax. They would each write three perfect sentences in a row, and then a fourth one would fall apart. But nevertheless, you can see them struggling on the page to develop a sense of plot, to develop their story, to have beginning, middles, and ends. And indeed, especially in Washington's case, he frequently uses images of nature as a metaphor for freedom, as does Wallace Turnage as well, particularly when he gets out into the ocean or when he finds himself finally breathing his first breaths of freedom, looking back at the shore he had escaped from. He converts that into this rigid juxtaposition of slavery and freedom. And I would just say this, too, that both of them seem to believe they only had one story to tell, and that was the story of their escape. In Washington's case, we do get a real coming-of-age kind of autobiography. But in Turnage's case, he doesn't seem to think that we would care about the rest of his story.
But both of them seem to see freedom as being connected to being able to earn a wage.
Absolutely.
But you said that was a struggle, even though they were both literate?
Yes. In fact, Washington ends his narrative with the rather mundane sentence, I am now working two jobs. It's in the District of Columbia, one of them working on the docks, the other working for a bottling company, and he says, I make $1.25 per week. That's the last sentence. Similarly, in Wallace Turnage's ending, in his last few paragraphs, he makes a very poignant case out of now being able to keep whatever money he makes to earn a wage. It's easy for us to forget today what that must have meant in 1865 to a former slave.
What happened to the $4 billion that...
the $4 billion invested in American slaves?
Yeah. From the North.
Some fortunes were lost, but the truth is those merchants, those banking interests and those merchants in New York City made out pretty well in the end nevertheless. They invested their money in sugar mills. They invested their money in a lot of other things. They invested their money in textiles. And through the course of the war, and particularly in military production, a lot of those merchants who had been invested in Southern cotton began to invest in production for materiel for the Union war effort by 1863, 64, and 65. But I also should add that the confiscation of slave property in the American Civil War is the largest single confiscation of property any time in American history.
Now, they both moved to the north, sort of, but Washington was always a kind of a southern city.
Indeed.
And New York was the most sympathetic to the South. Could they have moved elsewhere?
Oh, they could have moved elsewhere, but Washington and his wife Annie found they lived in a deep black community in Washington, D.C. They helped found the Shiloh Baptist Church. They lived out their life in what we call Foggy Bottom, right in the area which is today George Washington University. And also, Washington, D.C. had a very good education system.
David W. Blight's book, A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom, Including Their Own Narratives of Emancipation, is published by Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, Craig Unger explains why he claims that George W. Bush should be held personally responsible for the current mess in Iraq. Also, the latest in our States of the Union election feature with a look at the president's home state, Texas. We'll hear about a new movie called Badland, plus an update on the Nation of Islam movement now that Louis Farrakhan is ill and has ceded control. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Scott Goldberg, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angie Sheldon, Fran Jacobs, Rachel Krantz, Stephanie Hughes, and Bridget Bergen. Jay Kaut was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.